The chair will now recognize the following colleagues of ours who have the aforementioned bills introduced. The Honorable Jim McDermott on H.R. 2678, the Honorable Bart Stupak on H.R. 1358, Honorable Brian Barrett on H.R. 3084, and the Honorable Denny Rigberg on H.R. 3120. My colleagues, we welcome you to the Committee on Natural Resources, commend each of you for your leadership on these issues. You are welcome to proceed in the manner you wish. We, of course, have your prepared testimony. It will be made part of the record. And following your prepared testimony, without objection, you are invited to join the panel to listen to the witnesses that will follow you. Jim, you want to kick it off?
Okay. Thank you, Nick.
Yep.
Good morning. I want to thank the chairman and the committee for holding this hearing, which addresses an important issue for my district. I represent the city of Seattle. Now, that name, Seattle, came from the name of the chief of the Duwamish tribe, Chief Self. Like other tribal leaders, he signed a treaty with the United States. It was the Treaty of Point Elliott, signed in 1855. The Duwamish was not, they ceded their land, but they're not their sovereignty, in exchange for guaranteed fishing rights and monetary benefits. The Duwamish never got these benefits. However, they have sought them since 1977. In short, this hearing has a long time coming. The recognition process for the Duwamish, a tribe of about 600 people, has been protracted beyond what any tribe should have to endure. The Bush administration used a procedural flaw to overturn a positive final determination acknowledging the Duwamish as an existing Indian tribe under federal law. Ever since, the Duwamish pursued remedies through the administrative process. The reason they didn't go to court, because they didn't have any money. Poor small tribes can't use the courts the way the large tribes can. But we find ourselves today with one inescapable conclusion. The Duwamish did what they were supposed to do, and still they are not met with justice. We have a responsibility to uphold our end of the trust relationship between Indian tribes and the federal government. After so many years, it's time to act. The presumption that the tribe had ceased to exist is never officially supported, and no moment of dissolution was recorded because nothing could be further from the truth. I introduced the Duwamish Recognition Act to grant long overdue federal recognition of the Duwamish and restore the credibility of the United States government in this matter once and for all. There will be witnesses today who oppose the bill, and they oppose it for a variety of reasons. Although the Duwamish are listed on the United States government's memorandum as late as 1966, you will hear testimony that they have no proof of existence since 1900. Because the Duwamish were never given a reservation, many were forced off their lands to live on other tribal lands to survive. They were scattered, but they'd never lost their identity as Duwamish people, and they have overcome and actually regrouped as few indigenous groups have been able to do. They've actually built a longhouse in Seattle in their old property. The opposition calls for proof that the tribe maintained a separate community. Yet the Duwamish here today and their community back home, in fact, are living proof they have done just exactly that against the odds. Any other concerns about the outcome of federal recognition should be considered in the context of economic and other issues, not whether the Duwamish are a tribe. The Duwamish have proved or provided the government extensive evidence of their claim. They are a continually existing tribe. In fact, they are a tribe that has existed continuously in the face of great opposition, and they deserve recognition. Recently, I got a letter from a fifth-grade class at Holy Family Parish in my district. The teacher wrote that the students were, and I quote, shocked to find out that a tribe doesn't legally exist in the eyes of the U.S. government. He asked me to write back because he said, my students are predominantly sons and daughters of immigrants. They are not confident they have a voice. My hope is to teach them they have a voice and the written word can produce results. That's what this hearing is really all about. I extend my appreciation again to the chairman and the committee. I want to give just a moment to say it gives me great pleasure to add a word of welcome to Cecile Hansen, who's the chairman of the Duwamish tribe, and to introduce her to all of you. She's sitting right behind me. She's the great-great-grandniece of famous Chief Self. She has dedicated her life to this cause and her people. Not only is her tribe better off for it, but all of Seattle is enriched by the indigenous culture the Duwamish bring to the city. So I thank her for coming all this way once again to go through this process. We are pursuing promises the federal government made more than 150 years ago to her great-great-granduncle on her people's behalf, and I look forward to hearing her testimony. I would call your attention to the testimony by Michael Anderson, who was the official in the Clinton administration who actually recognized them and signed a set of documents saying that they were a tribe. He didn't sign the second and third copy for reasons they were a pile, a stack of papers, and they were actually recognized. And 2 days after the Bush administration came into office, they de-recognized it because there were two signatures not on a second and third copy of the documents. To me, that's bureaucratic nonsense. The decision was made. They should have been granted, and I look forward to your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hastings, Mr. Kilty, thanks for your steadfast support for the Burt Lake Tribe. Before I go much further, I got to acknowledge Grace Napolitano's performance last night. She played well, and you're being too modest. You pitched the last inning, and they got them three up, three down. Good job. She did. But at this table, we want four up and four down. Four out the door. Four out the door. You're right. But let me point out that my bill, H.R. 1358, is not a traditional tribal recognition bill. It simply reaffirms the tribal status of the Burt Lake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. The Burt Lake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, whose historic name is the Sheboygan Band, has been federally recognized as an individual tribe in the past. The tribe is a signatory to the 1836 Treaty of Washington and the 1855 Treaty of Detroit. In both of these treaties, Burt Lake was recognized by the United States government on a government-to-government basis. Then, in 1911, after the tribe's land had been taken and its village burned, the United States filed a land ownership lawsuit on behalf of the tribe. The suit specifically referred to them as the Sheboygan Band of Indians, a tribe of Indians under the care, control, and guardianship of the United States. However, in 1934, Burt Lake was not allowed to reorganize under the Indian Reorganization Act because the tribe had been forced off its land. In similar instances, federal courts and Congress have determined that this does not terminate a tribe's federal status. Yet in the 1970s, when the Interior Department produced a list of federally recognized tribes, Burt Lake was not included. More than 25 years, Burt Lake has waited on the Interior Department to reaffirm its tribal status. As Interior continued to delay consideration of its petition, Burt Lake turned to Congress for help. In 1994, Burt Lake had legislation pending before the Congress that was heading towards consideration on the House floor, along with the Little Traverse and Little River Band recognition bills. Both of those were accepted. However, House leadership resisted the inclusion of Burt Lake without a hearing, despite their issue being identical to Little Traverse Tribe. Ultimately, Burt Lake agreed to wait until 1995 for their turn to be recognized. That year came and went. In 1997, this committee unanimously approved a Burt Lake reaffirmation bill. The Interior Department then promised Congress that Burt Lake administrative petition would be decided within 6 months, which delayed further action by the 105th Congress. Interior did not fulfill its commitment to the rule on the tribe's administrative position. 9 years later, Interior finally made a decision. In September of 2006, Interior declined to acknowledge the Burt Lake Band's tribal status, even though the department agreed that Burt Lake is the same tribe that signed the treaties of 1836 and 1855 and was represented by the United States in their land lawsuit in 1911. What was the Interior's rationale behind this decision? Their rationale was some members of the Burt Lake Band had joined a neighboring tribe to obtain health care services. Interior failed to mention that its own officials encouraged Burt Lake members to do so as it reviewed its case. Although some Burt Lake members did join the neighboring tribe for health services, the Burt Lake Band has still maintained an independent and distinct community. Nonetheless, the Interior Department has declined to acknowledge the tribe's existence, preventing members of Burt Lake from obtaining health and education benefits in their own community. However, the Interior Department did recognize did note in its decision that, and I quote, Congress may consider taking legislative action to recognize petitioners that do not meet the specific requirements of the acknowledgement regulations, but may have merit. In other words, we're not going to do it, even though their claim has merit, and they're looking for Congress to recognize the Burt Lake ban. I have reintroduced H.R. 1358 with the support of Congressman Kildee to reaffirm Burt Lake's ban tribal status after decades of neglect and disenfranchisement. The Burt Lake ban has letters from Sheboygan County, the city of Sheboygan, the Catholic Diocese of nearby Gaylord, Michigan, all supporting federal tribal status of the Burt Lake ban. I'm hopeful that this Congress will finally right this wrong and provide members of the Burt Lake ban the tribal status they deserve. The Burt Lake ban has been waiting for decades. I appreciate the support of this committee has given the tribe as recently as last year when you unanimously voted to support the tribe's identification. And I want to thank Chairman Kurt Chambers for his patience, and he will be testifying here later today. I thank the committee for holding this hearing, and I look forward to working with you to pass this important legislation. Thank you for having me here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member, and distinguished colleagues, friends, and members of the committee. Today we have an opportunity to do something extraordinary: restore justice and right a historical wrong. The Chinook people deserve restoration of their status as a fully recognized tribe. It is within our power to make that right a reality, and we should do so. It has been my profound privilege to work with the Chinook on this issue before I was elected and in the 11 years of service in Congress since then. The Chinook people have worked and waited many decades. The reason they have worked so long and hard is because they know their cause is just and because they feel a profound responsibility for their ancestors and to their future generations. Those are the same reasons that motivate me, and it is why we are here today. Last evening, I spoke by telephone with Ken Burns, the celebrated American documentary filmmaker who, along with Dayton Duncan, created the magnificent work chronicling the exploration of Lewis and Clark and the Corps of Discovery. Few Americans know the story of Lewis and Clark better than these two men, and none have told that story more eloquently. In speaking with Mr. Burns last evening, he expressed and asked me to communicate to you his enthusiastic and unequivocal support for restoring full status to the Chinook. He and Dayton Duncan know in intimate and extensive detail the tremendous historical importance of the Chinook people. That importance derives not simply in their relationship with Lewis and Clark, but as the dominant people of the lower Columbia River since long before Europeans came. That presence on the river, that importance has continued without interruption from long before the arrival of Europeans in the Northwest to the present day. There is absolutely no doubt that the Chinook people have an uninterrupted history as a tribe. With us today are distinguished elected leaders, and I emphasize elected leaders of the Chinook tribe. They are part of a long tradition of tribal leaders who have struggled on behalf of their people. Prior to Chairman Ray Gardner, from whom you'll hear in a moment, Chairman Gary Johnson, Chief Cliff Snyder, and countless others carried on the good fight for their people. They and those before them deserve our thanks and our respect, but more importantly, they deserve our action. I said earlier we have an opportunity to right a historical wrong. I will not go into great detail on this, as the story is available elsewhere, but what this committee needs to understand is this. In 1851, the Chinook people signed a treaty with the United States government that would have given them full recognition along with certain hunting, fishing, and governance rights. For a variety of reasons, not reflecting on the legitimacy of the Chinook claims, the Senate failed to ratify that treaty. The Chinook and the House have something in common there with frustrations over the Senate. 4 years later, then-Territorial Governor Stevens gave the Chinook an untenable choice. They would have to either move far to the east to the plateau lands of the Yakima people or move north to be absorbed by the Quinault, who were then, and to some degree, as recent actions seem to indicate, are still a rival tribe, but certainly were then. In effect, Governor Stevens was asking the Chinook to embark on what would have been a northwest version of the trail, or perhaps in this case, the River of Tears. The choice was leave your homeland and cease to exist as an independent people, or we will declare that you no longer exist and take away your rights and your sacred land, river, and ocean by force, filibuster, or fiat. My friends and colleagues, what would you have done? My belief is you would have done exactly what the Chinook people did. You would have said no. The Chinook people knew then who they were. They knew where the Creator had placed them on this earth, and neither Governor Stevens nor any other tribe then or now could erase that knowledge or change that reality, regardless of what they may have declared. That is the historical wrong we are seeking to correct today. The injustice we're seeking to correct is the ongoing failure of this government to recognize that the Chinook existed then, exist today, have always existed, and deserve full recognition as much as any other tribe in this great country. In seeking restoration, the Chinook have worked closely with local community leaders and have the full support of newspapers throughout the region. They have the support from their immediate tribal neighbors to the north, the Shoalwater Bay Tribe, as well as their neighbors across the river, the Grand Ronde Tribe. I also want you to know I spoke just this morning with our former colleague, Elizabeth Furse, who knows probably as much about, with maybe the exception of Mr. Kildee and the chair, about tribal issues as anyone. She has given her full support to this and sends her best regards as well. The Chinook chairman and elders who are here today can tell you their story far better than I. I would only ask this. Listen to what they have to say. Listen to Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan. Listen to the descendants of Lewis and Clark. Listen to the sound of the mighty river and the great ocean. And I trust if we do that, we will do the right thing. I said at the outset we have an opportunity. I believe, in fact, we have a responsibility. I thank you for your time and urge the committee move passage of this legislation and move it forward for prompt floor action. Thank you again.
Chairman Rahal, Ranking Member Hastings, let me extend my appreciation for including my legislation in this hearing. I also want to thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians from my home state of Montana. As you know, Montana is a massive state. Geographically, my district is the second largest in the country, second only to Mr. Young's district of Alaska. From east to west, Montana covers as much distance as Washington, D.C. to Chicago. In terms of population, though, I represent more people than anyone in Congress. While the average congressional size represents around 650,000 people, I have close to 960,000. As a result of its size, Montana also has 11 recognized tribes and 7 Indian reservations, making up 6% of our population. Native Americans are by far the largest minority in the state of Montana. And while a state as diverse as Montana rarely provides a homogeneous point of view on many issues that we are confronted with in Congress today, recognition for the Little Shell Tribe near Great Falls is not a controversial one in my state. In fact, 9 years ago, the state of Montana formally recognized the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa Indians. And I've worked across the aisle with Montana's 2 Democratic senators to extend the recognition by the federal government. For us, this federal recognition is about rising above politics and bureaucratic red tape to do the right thing. That's why I hope this committee will favorably report H.R. 3120. It's the right thing to do, and it's already taken too long. More than 100 years ago, the federal government failed the Little Shell Indians in much the same way that it is failing them now. In 1892, while federal treaty negotiations were carried out, Chief Thomas Little Shell was in Montana on a hunting trip. While he was gone, the tribal rolls were cut, and his tribal land was sold. Mr. Chairman, imagine if upon returning from Washington, D.C., after a flight from your district, you were told that a significant number of your constituents were informed by the IRS that they were no longer residents of West Virginia. Imagine further that a healthy portion of your district was sold to Virginia. I don't imagine you'd be very happy about that, nor would Virginia. So maybe you can understand why Chief Little Shell chose not to accept the take-it-or-lose-it results of a negotiation that he was not a party to. The cost of that impossible choice is still being felt today across the span of generations. Left out of the treaty, the Little Shell Tribe became known by some by a different moniker, the Landless Indians. In 1978, the Little Shell filed a federal recognition petition with the Department of Interior. Today, more than 30 years later, they're still waiting, despite the approval of a preliminary recognition status after the formal recognition of the tribe by the state of Montana. At every turn, the Department of Interior has promised action only then to postpone it. Meanwhile, another generation of Little Shell suffers the consequences of choices that were made long before they were born. We have the power to correct a historic injustice. The Little Shell tells a story about an old man who had a life-saving knowledge of fire, but refused to share it because he wanted to keep it to himself. He kept the fire hidden away, denying the Little Shell tribe access to the warmth in the wintertime. Eventually, a brave young man hatched a plan to secretly take a spark of fire from the selfish man and use it to kindle flame. The warmth of that fire, once secure, kept the little shell warm during the long winter months. In the grand scheme of what we do here, it's a small thing for Congress to provide a spark of federal recognition for the little shell tribe of the Chippewa Indians. The benefit for those who receive that spark can be the life-changing and permanent. Folks in my neck of the woods understand the power of a single spark that it can have. The federal government has hoarded its fire too long. Let's work together to light a fire for the Little Shell Tribe in Montana. In addition to those that are testifying from the state of Montana, from the tribe on behalf of the Little Shell recognition, I'd like to ask unanimous consent to have the testimony submitted for the record from one of my former congressional staffers, who is also a proud Marine and was the vice chairman of the Little Shell Tribe. His name is James Parker Shields. He sits in the audience. He will not be testifying today, but I'd ask unanimous consent to have his testimony put into the record as well. And I thank you again for this opportunity.